value of diversity and cross-cultural exchange has long been celebrated, especially in the global north, where accessing a foreign culture was likened to holding the keys to a new dimension of reality. It wasn't just about acquiring knowledge of another culture, it was about the generative power of cultural crossroads, a space where ideas, perspectives, and possibilities flourish. With the rapid pace of globalization, many of us are encouraged to look beyond our roots and embrace the broader world, with the promise that understanding those different from ourselves would enrich us all. But what happens when this ideal is complicated by lived experiences? For children born into multifaceted cultural identities they never chose, the narrative isn't always one of enrichment. In this episode, we explore three stories of navigating these tangled spaces. One story examines how the enduring weight of one classroom memory can leave a person stuck in an eternal limbo between the identities others impose and the ones they yearn to claim. Another delves into the challenge of fostering a third space identity to resist the cultural erosion and dilution that may result from a collision of worldviews. Finally, we hear about the importance of seeing yourself reflected in your education, where the lack of representation in the classroom can leave students questioning their place in a system that fails to recognize them. These narratives underscore a common truth, that education plays a pivotal role in shaping how individuals navigate the complexities of identity. How can education influence their navigation through these intertwined identities? How should education empower them to find their sense of self? Education has the potential to turn dissonance into coherence. By rethinking education, we can create spaces that promote understanding and connection to advance social sustainability, ensuring that complexity becomes a source of vitality, not fragmentation. The difference between not having a thought at all and actively willing a thought away is very significant to me. The first is effortless, or more accurately, it's less than effortless. It's passive, a null state, the absence of any deliberate action or even awareness. But the second requires work. So much work is exhausting. Because to will a thought away, you have to first notice it. You have to track its little tremors as it creeps in, recognize it for what it is, and then summon the energy to force it down, not just once, but continuously. It's a sustained campaign. You're standing at this imaginary trapdoor, holding it shut with your whole body, and every muscle in your brain and willpower tensed. Because the thought, the creatures, thrash. They don't want to go. And here's the really insidious part. You're not just holding them down. You're simultaneously pretending to yourself that you're not doing it at all, that the trapdoor isn't there, that the creatures aren't real. You're trying to both suppress and erase, which is a contradiction your brain somehow accepts. And maybe, if you work hard enough, long enough, the thrashing starts to fade, and you convince yourself the thing is gone, that you've succeeded. But I haven't. My fight isn't just with the thoughts, but with the memory that feeds them, that keeps them alive. A classroom laughing, a teacher smiling. It was one class, 70 minutes. But it chained some fragment of my 14-year-old self to every iteration of who I've been since and who I am now. There is a relic, too. A physical, material remnant. The actual assignment. A creative writing task set by our teacher, asking us to compose a diary entry of a mainland Chinese tourist in Hong Kong. The classmate who wrote the piece went on to become head boy. His diary told of a mainland Chinese boy who squatted in the middle of a public square and defecated on the marble tiles, then washed himself in the fountain. When the future head boy read this aloud, the class laughed. The teacher liked it. What a vivid and accurate description, she had said. This task, she said us, was her response to a crowd-funded ad in one of the most widely circulated local papers which depicted mainland Chinese people as locusts. The ad was bright yellow, the color that would later become symbolic of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movements. The paper, Apple Daily, will later be celebrated and commemorated for its fiercely pro-democracy editorial position before being shut down by Hong Kong's national security law. At 14, though, what I knew was only that I was the only mainland Chinese student in the room, and I had never been more visible. Or more invisible. I think about that teacher a lot, about the magnitude of influence a teacher has on their students, and how she had chose to wield it. How she could have used that assignment to foster understanding, to talk about the weight of stereotypes, the damage of divisiveness. Instead, she chose to smile, to let us, 14-year-olds, walk away thinking that mockery was cleverness and cruelty was acceptable. It makes me wonder if she thought she was teaching us something important. And in a way, maybe she was, but not the thing I wish she had taught. I also thought about myself a lot, about how I had failed. Failed to stand up, failed to defend myself, failed to prove I wasn't what they thought I was. For years, I believed it was my job to show everyone that I wasn't like the others. And in doing so, I absorbed the very attitude I despised. To prove I was an exception, I had to first believe the rule that the average mainland Chinese person was something to be ashamed of. This is what my international school education didn't tell me about being a global citizen, or what they failed to convince me of. They sell it as this grand, borderless identity where you belong everywhere. But I found the opposite is true. Belonging everywhere is the same as belonging nowhere. Trying to understand both sides of every argument doesn't make me a bridge. It makes me the battleground. I tore myself apart trying to hold the pieces together. The weight of every perspective presses on me, and there's no room left for my own. I think sometimes about what could have happened if that teacher had used her power differently. If she had invited the class to question their assumptions, to look for a middle ground instead of planting themselves so firmly in one. Maybe we could have learned that identity isn't about distancing yourself from others, but finding the threads that connect you. But she hadn't. And so I carry this with me. This memory, these thoughts, this creature. It shouldn't have mattered so much. A teacher smiled, a class laughed, but it did. That moment left me feeling like a perpetual outsider, some defect I carried into every human relationship I've had since. It's not just a sense of inferiority, though that's part of it. It's this constant low-level hum of timidity, an almost reflexive guilt, as though my existence itself needs qualifying, apologizing for. This is the legacy of that day, the strange half-life of global citizenship I was meant to embrace but never could. For years, I tried to make it work, tried to tell myself there was something inherently better about belonging to more places than one. But maybe there's no inherent value to that at all. Maybe knowing one culture deeply, being connected to it and grounded in it, is as good or even better than flitting between worlds you can never fully belong to. There's something stable about that kind of rootedness, something I'll never have. For me, global citizenship has been less about bridges and more about chasms, unbridgeable ones. And the most painful chasms are the ones within yourself. Eventually, I stopped hoping for a middle ground. Stopped trying to balance between mainland Chinese people and Hong Kong people, to be accepted by both and failing at both. That hope, it turns out, was a kind of naivety. Or maybe it was arrogance, thinking I could somehow transcend histories and politics far larger than me. Instead, I chose something else. I found friendships with people who are neither, people who don't carry those same expectations or histories. There's a kind of freedom in it, in knowing that I won't want to find a sense of belonging to them, in knowing that they don't need me to belong to them because I was never theirs to begin with. And there's no disappointment because the terms are clear. I am not one of them, and I never will be. That's fine. In the end, maybe belonging doesn't have to mean being accepted by others. Maybe it's enough to accept myself, even if no one else does.
Sun streams through the windows of the National University of Vietnam's library as I sort through documents for our Banana Kids Cultural Preservation Project. The term makes me pause. Yellow on the outside, white on the inside. A label that embodies what post-colonial theorist Homi Bhabha calls the ambivalence of colonial discourse. Born to the Vietnamese parents in Prague, this ambivalence isn't just theoretical. It's written into my educational biography. My earliest memories are of navigating Prague's international school system while maintaining my Czech national education requirements. 9 years of mandatory Czech education alongside an international curriculum created what anthropologist Arjun Abdurai terms disjunctures, gaps between cultural flows where new forms of identity emerge. In Czech classes, I was immersed in the language and culture of my birth country, while international classes opened windows to global perspectives. However, neither space fully captured what sociologist Stuart Hall describes as the production of identity, the ongoing process of becoming that characterizes diaspora experiences. The theoretical implications of this dual identity became clear during my GCSE and IB years, when English became my primary academic language for the first time. I remember sitting in IB English Literature, analyzing Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, when something clicked. We were discussing how identity is shaped by language and space, and suddenly my own experience had theoretical scaffolding. Here I was, a Czech national of Vietnamese heritage, discussing English literature while thinking about cultural authenticity. It's a living proof of what cultural theorist James Clifford calls the traveling cultures phenomenon. And during our theory of knowledge presentation, I explored how different cultural frameworks approach the concept of knowledge itself. I compared the Vietnamese concept of tự học, which is self-learning, with Western pedagogical models. And this wasn't just an academic exercise. It was my first encounter with what Bhabha terms the third space of cultural identity, where new forms of understanding emerge from the collision of different worldviews. This concept would later become central to my research on educational identity formation among diaspora communities. And critics of this third space approach, particularly traditional Vietnamese educators I've worked with at the Ministry of Affairs, argue that it represents a form of cultural dilution. They cite sociologist Pierre Bourdieu's concept of cultural capital, suggesting that when Vietnamese youth adopt Western educational paradigms, they risk losing the distinct cultural capital that connects them to their heritage. It's a valid concern that echoes through our Banana Kids project. How do we facilitate cultural evolution without enabling cultural erosion? Our research at the National University of Vietnam addresses this challenge through what we call dynamic cultural preservation. Drawing on Stuart Hall's theory of cultural identity as a production that's never complete, always in process, we've developed educational frameworks that treat cultural identity not as a fixed inheritance, but as an active dialogue between past and present. This approach directly aligns with UNESCO's Sustainable Development Goal 4.7, which emphasizes education's role in promoting cultural diversity and sustainable development. Let me share a concrete example from our work. We implemented a project-based learning initiative that embodies the Vietnamese principle of học đi đôi với hành, learning paired with practice. Students researched their family histories while learning digital storytelling techniques. One group created a documentary about their grandparents' migration from Vietnam to Europe, incorporating traditional Vietnamese narrative structures while using modern media tools. The results were remarkable, really. It was 80% of participants reported stronger connections to their cultural heritage and simultaneously developing critical digital literacy skills. But traditionalists raise important points that we must address. In response to their concerns, we've implemented what we call cultural anchoring points. So it's core elements of Vietnamese cultural knowledge and practice that serve as foundations for cultural evolution. And these include, well, one, structured intergenerational dialogue programs, two, which are regular community cultural audits, and three, collaborative curriculum development with traditional cultural practitioners. And this understanding shapes my current work with the Vietnamese Ministry of Affairs, where we're developing programs that don't just preserve Vietnamese culture as something static, but engage with how it evolves across generations and contexts too. Our framework for culturally responsive teaching builds on what education theorist Gloria Ladson Billings terms culturally sustaining pedagogy, extending it to address the unique challenges of transnational identity formation. And for fellow researchers and educators working with multicultural students, our findings suggest several key strategies. One, recognize cultural identity in education as what Baba calls a hybrid space, not a zero-sum game between tradition and innovation. Two, leverage linguistic diversity as a cognitive resource, supporting what sociolinguist Li Wei terms translanguaging practices. And three, create educational spaces that validate multiple epistemologies, drawing on what philosopher Boaventura de Sousa Santos calls cognitive justice. Critics might argue that this approach complicates standardized education systems. I mean, they're not wrong, it does, but my journey from international school student to now master's student has shown me that this complexity is precisely what makes education transformative. As educational theorist Michael Apple argues, standardization often serves to reproduce social inequalities rather than address them. And this work contributes to what UNESCO calls transformative education for sustainable development. It suggests that truly sustainable educational systems must do more than preserve cultural heritage. They must create spaces for cultural innovation while maintaining core cultural connections. And as we work towards SDG 4's vision of inclusive, equitable education, we're finding that the answer lies not in choosing between tradition and innovation, but in understanding how they can mutually reinforce each other. As I conclude this reflection, I'm reminded of a Vietnamese proverb my parents often quoted, "Không có thầy, đồ mày làm nên." Without teachers, you cannot succeed. But perhaps the most important lesson is learning to be your teacher, to find worth in the very complexity that once made you feel adrift. In the end, sustainable development in education must start with sustaining our multiple selves, creating spaces where future generations can inherit not just knowledge, but the wisdom to navigate their own cultural crossroads.
In the UK as a black British Kenyan, I felt like I had to navigate throughout within the system to be able to understand myself, but not just myself, but the systems that I was put into. In secondary school in particular, there wasn't really a platform for students to be able to vocalize or to express their cultural identities. The curriculum during the time when I was at school didn't really give us that platform to recognize ourselves in different spaces, whether that be in history, whether that be in English. The curriculum almost felt a bit limiting, and upon reflection, It was restrictive to developing more than just what we could see, right? So when preparing for an exam, of course, we learned those key aspects, application of knowledge, analysing, and, you know, being critical thinkers and evaluating. But in terms of the content of which we were evaluating or analysing, at times it was just more of a clear-cut set curriculum which more or less repeated itself for many years but didn't necessarily represent nor demonstrate different cultures or various insights into the way people live, not just outside but also within the UK. So I feel like there was a restrictive insight into other people's cultures and to other people's understanding, whether that not just be in the curriculum, but also through extracurricular activities, whether that be debate club or whether that be book clubs. Back then when I was in school, which wasn't too long ago, but I think upon reflection back when I was in school and then maybe now students in the curriculum right now can kind of see themselves in books, can see themselves in the curriculum and identify themselves in the curriculum, and also be able to speak out for it's relatable to them. But building up from the, you know, the key criteria, being able to identify and recognize oneself in the curriculum just gives students that boost. It gives students emphasis on understanding what it is I'm learning and why am I learning what I'm learning. And I think being able to recognize and have that relatability with, you know, the curriculum, with the content that's being taught, it makes it worthwhile for the student, and it just has a lot of power. And I think I was able to do this more in university. So for my undergrad, I was part of a network, a Black student network. And within this network, we were able to have these discussions. We were able to dive deeper into understanding who we are in this space of, you know, being Black, British, or Black African, or Black Caribbean, however we identified ourselves in the space that we were in. We were able to read books and have the discussions and critique, you know, whatever it is that we have come across in education, in the media, and delve in deeply to understand how and what does this represent. Does it represent me or not? Does it represent me in a good light, or does it represent my people, my culture in a good light or in a bad light? And if so, why? So I feel as if I've never not been proud of where I'm from, or I've never not known, because I've always known. I think growing up, I've always wanted to know more. And I think growing up, I've always wanted to, you know, be more proud of where I come from. Yes, I was raised in Britain, but I also have my background, my culture, my heritage, my ancestors, my family are originally back from Kenya, and that is where I'm from. But I think for people who perhaps don't have that platform right now, or can't necessarily find their voice right now, I think it's important for systems or school systems to be able to provide that space for students to have those discussions, for students to meet up who look the same or who have gone through similar, you know, cultural journeys or whatever the case may be, just to be able to facilitate a safe space, and for students to be able to recognize themselves in those spaces is so important, because it really makes or breaks one's experience in education. I think it's just really important, because we find ourselves through what we do, where we are majority of the time, which is in school, which is at work, university. And if we can't find ourselves, or if we can't see ourselves, or if there's no relatability with what we're doing and where we are to who we are, I feel that creates a gap. And it just leaves us asking more questions. But that's why we have our voices, to be able to speak out and to ask said questions and to desire to know, to know more, to find out more. But we must also recognize that not everybody has the opportunity, or not everybody has the ability to use their voice. Maybe there might be restrictions being placed on them being able to use their voice. So for those who can, we must be able to try to be the voice of the voiceless, whose cultures, whose identities are being misheard or misrepresented.